Welcome to the Guff Men. I was able to pull James away from looking at Natalie and Brulia pictures long enough to do a podcast. So welcome to the podcast, James.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Welcome to you.
Just before we get started, just wanted to mention to check out our website, themcguffmen.com. We write weekly articles. There are other audio podcasts. There's video podcasts. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Just search The McGuffin Men, all one word. Also send us emails, themcguffinmen@gmail.com, or follow us on Twitter at The McGuffin Men, all one word, all the time. And just if you like the podcast, tell your friends. We put some work into it, so we would like it if more people listened. And also give us, maybe rate us on iTunes if you happen to enjoy it. It gets us more notice the more ratings we have. So thanks for listening, and let's get started.
Welcome to The MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Michael Sarah. Unless you don't want it to be, that's fine. It doesn't have to be if you don't want it to. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex. With me, as always, is James.
Hello, Alex.
Hello, James.
You're a university graduate, yes?
I am, yeah, that's true.
The University of Western Ontario alumni?
Yeah, that's true.
Actually, it's now Western Ontario, eh? You know, or Western University?
Yeah, I knew that.
Anyway, remember...
I did, actually.
I say who knew too much to things that people obviously knew. I'm just getting that out.
Asking people, did you know? Then them saying yes, and then you saying, who knew?
I'm asking for a complete list of everybody who knows these things.
You're a postmodern storytelling fan.
Yes. You remember the poster sale?
Yes.
When they... That was huge. So many posters. But yeah, it was like thousands of posters, and it was...
I don't think I have any posters from that poster sale, though. I know I've bought some. Like, I still have a picture of Natalie Portman in The Professional, like that gun picture.
Yeah.
I dig that picture, but all of my posters, for the most part, are from Rogers when I worked at a video store.
Yeah. No, I didn't buy anything at the poster sale, but I remember it every year.
It's a university thing. Like, yeah, it's not just a Western thing.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I mean, they had thousands of them, but it seems like they got... The old 80-20 ratio, probably 80% of their business on 20% of their posters, as they say.
Yeah.
Like, probably. It was lots of the same ones being sold, or not necessarily at the poster sale, but walking around, university dorms.
Yeah.
You see a lot of the same ones repeating.
I did buy one poster from the poster sale that was probably not included in the 20% of things that sold a lot, in that it was a Hard to Kill poster starring Steven Seagal.
So. Yes. Probably not the most popular, but big in
number one in my heart.
Big on the ironic charts. The ironic sales chart.
I authentically love Steven Seagal, ironically. Thank you.
What were the big posters that you remember, like, everyone having or seeing people buy a lot?
I feel like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind was probably a big one for people our age.
Yeah, I think maybe a bit older than us, but the still from Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, the Jules and John Travolta's character.
Yeah, I can't remember his name either. But yeah.
Michael Madsen's brother.
Vincent Vega. That's what there it is. That was a big one, or just the cover of Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
But that was one I remember. Other one of those two girls kissing. Do you remember that one?
No.
A lot of people had that one, too.
Okay. It's like a high school thing.
I remember it from both yourself. But another big one was Fight Club.
Oh, yes. I never would have guessed that.
Go along with it.
Yeah. Hey, I went along with it by not saying that immediately.
Okay, fine. I'll give you that. I'll meet you halfway there. Yeah. But that was a big one, and I mean... I was late seeing Fight Club. Actually, I'll tell the story about my seeing Fight Club.
Do it.
Spoilers, if you haven't seen Fight Club, they're about to come. Yeah,
you were the last person to see Fight Club.
They're pygmy tribes who saw it before I did. So Fight Club came out, and everyone was really big on it. We'll get to its reception. But a lot of people from my age and 5 years, we'll say older, were very big on Fight Club.
Yep.
And I heard a lot about how good it was, and I don't know why I didn't see it quickly, but I didn't. And time passed, and I heard it overanalyzed, and I found out about the ending, and I had millions of people tell me exactly what happened in the movie and why I'd like it so much. And I just got so sick of people saying why haven't you seen this? Oh, you'd love this. That I just started lying and said that I had seen Fight Club. So if I told you in the past 8 years that I saw Fight Club, that was a lie.
Anytime before December 2011, it was a lie.
It was a total lie, and I'm sorry, but it's the way it is. And now I saw it in December, as you said, probably. And now I know what the whole hubbub's about.
Cool story.
Pretty good, eh?
Yeah, yep. I'm happy you finally got around to it.
Yeah.
I've realized that picking podcast topics is a way to get you to watch movies that you should see.
This is just some, like, volunteer service you do to get me to see good movies.
Exactly. I hate podcasting, but I'm just... you say you like movies, and I have to make you watch movies that people care about.
Right. And
so you don't just watch Arrested Development every day for the rest of your life.
I haven't seen that show.
I'm sorry, you moved on to Community. I apologize.
Now I'm onto The Wire.
Okay.
actually, this is going to be one of those ones I think we disagree about in general.
Yep.
Which is fine.
It's totally fine.
I'll allow you to have different opinions. But yeah, we're talking about Fight Club today, if you couldn't tell. 1999 film.
Yep.
Directed by?
David Fincher.
Starring?
David Fincher's lens. No. Brad Pitt, Edward Norton, Helena Bonham Carter, Meatloaf a Day.
Dolly Grip by?
Meatloaf a Day.
I don't know if that's even a thing. Those are two words I see in credits. So that's Fight Club. What's the movie about?
Do you want, like, sort of a base, like, how it was advertised, what it's about? Or do you want what it's about?
Let's go with both. Give me both.
Okay, well,
hit me two times.
Well, I guess in both ways. It's sort of, okay, a very basic level. It's about frustrated 30-year-old males who sort of kind of don't really know their place in life.
Okay, a bit less abstract than that.
Well, that's the thing. The only way to... Okay, there's a way to... It's about people that get together in clubs and have and fight, because that's it. But that's, like, 30% of the movie.
Yeah.
So it's about 30s, or early 30s, like, late 20s, being confused as to what to do. It's about commercialism, you know, all these things.
Yes.
These are all things that are pretty... the movie's pretty upfront about it. You know, you don't have to dig deep to find these things. And it's not about fighting. It was advertised, you know, during wrestling and stuff. Like, it was going for the male grunt market, you know?
Yeah, and I didn't realize that. I mean, 1999, I don't really remember how marketing campaigns were going. It wasn't something I exactly paid attention to. But just in researching this one recently, yeah, I saw that it was on during WWE commercials and really just trying to get that. Here's a movie about fighting.
Well, and that's the thing. It's the easiest way to market the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I can see where they're coming from with that. But David Fincher was kind of apprehensive about that marketing approach for obvious reasons. I mean, I feel like that'll sell tickets, but then you'll have people very
didn't sell tickets. That's the thing.
And those people who went were probably very disappointed because they felt misled and probably had a very negative review of the movie just because it's not the kind of movie that... they were expecting or would like. I know you're not big on the synopsis, but do a brief one to know kind of where we're coming from.
So Edward Norton's character is the type of person, like, he works at a...
What's his name?
I don't know. What is it?
Ooh, deep.
And, he works at sort of like... Fuck. Where does he work? Like a car something company. Risk management, I guess.
Yeah, so what's his job is to basically... assess how dangerous these cars are that his company makes or that the company makes and contracts it out to him, whatever. And he determines how dangerous they are and if the money that it would cost to pay for a recall of all these automobile parts would be more than they'd have to pay out in lawsuits from wrongful death. So it's not... He struggles with this morally. He doesn't feel comfortable...
A little. He doesn't that much. With his job, you know, he buys a lot of stuff from the IKEA, whatever it's called, like Frug or something, the catalog that he's looking through, which is, you know, obviously IKEA's his apartment's filled with that stuff or IKEA stuff. And he has to fly around a lot. And he's basically just sort of living a corporate life. And he's kind of frustrated with this. And then he meets this guy, Tyler Durden, played by Brad Pitt. Durden's got sort of this sort of anti-commercial leaning. He lives in a house that, you know, boarded up, and he doesn't really spend a lot of money. And they sort of start this fight club, where dudes get together and fight to sort of just like be human together or something. Then this sort of descends into Project Mayhem, which is sort of basically domestic terrorism, where they're exposing the ills of the capital or corporate world or something. You know? And yeah, it's pretty much the movie.
Yeah. And that's, it's kind of hard to sum up because I don't know. I feel like some of those, like, as you said, he's, you know, highlighting these mistakes in the corporate world and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Highlighting problems with the corporate world.
Right. Yeah. I just don't feel that that gets done very successfully or clearly or effectively. I think his unhappiness comes across, but it's just not very specific and practical about what it is he dislikes and how he's taking steps to change it.
I think it gets across pretty well. It's sort of like the idea is that, let's look at the ending of the film. Turns out Edward Norton's character and Tyler Durden are the same person. The idea is that Edward Norton's character feels trapped in this world of his IKEA furniture and all that stuff in the corporate world and just flying from place to place, his single serving friends, all that stuff. And the idea is that type of world will eventually breed Tyler Durden. And it's sort of like this society, or this type of society, is just bad. It removes humanity and makes us all feel trapped. And the only way we feel we can get out of it is, well, first we start fighting because it's this very base thing. And then that fighting leads to Project Mayhem. And the sort of, it's that commercialism, that consumerism sort of leading towards terrorism. And that's the idea.
So you see Tyler as the bad guy, and this is kind of the worst outcome of when things get this corporate?
I don't see Tyler as the bad guy. I see commercialism as the bad guy, and the bad guy before the movie starts,
right?
And then that breeds Tyler, who in turn becomes a different kind of bad guy.
Okay.
And it's sort of, you know, trust.
So he's not a bad guy, in he's not a villain, but he's a,
well, he is a bad guy.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in the villain sense of the word, but he's not, he's just kind of a symptom. Like, he's a result of already being a villain. He is bad. He does negative things. He's a negative force, but his existence is predicated upon this more negative, as you said, like the first villain before this movie even starts.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Let's back it up a little bit.
Nice. I like it. Postmodern storytelling. We started at the end. Now we come back to the beginning. Not unlike Fight Club.
Give it the old Nipsey Doodle. This was a novel.
Mm-hmm. Chuck Palahniuk.
So glad I didn't have to say his name. But yeah, I just want to get back to kind of, you know, the advertising and where this movie was coming from. They bought the rights for this book for about $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't really sure how well this was going to go.
Yeah.
You can understand why a film studio would be apprehensive. I mean, even if you read this book and thought there's something very powerful here, this is a kind of a unique story.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough to translate into film and have it come off and, well, and mass market it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I agree. Reading the book, it's like, it reads like something that should absolutely be made into a movie. And it's very, like, Palahniuk's writing in that book, it's the only thing I've read by him, but it is very propulsive. Like, it keeps moving. And it's basically, they don't stray very far away from the book, with a few exceptions. And there aren't a lot of scenes cut out of the book that, you know, don't make it into the movie. And it's sort of told in the same sort of way, which is very, you know, it's very fast paced and, but also very not sort of mass Hollywood storytelling, particularly at the time.
And not kind of fast paced with endless action.
Yeah.
It's like that.
It jumps around a lot,
yeah.
You know, and doesn't really always give the viewer a ton of clues as to what's going on. And yeah, but David Fincher, mentions that he didn't have a lot of studio problems with the studio when making this movie, which just blows me away. Like,
yeah.
I can't believe, and it's not like David Fincher then was David Fincher who gets $150 million to make The Girl with Dragon Tattoo.
That's what I was going to say. It wasn't exactly established at this point.
Well, he had done Seven, which was a really well-respected movie, mm-hmm. and The Game had some big fans as well, and I mean, we both think those are good movies, but he was
critical appreciation doesn't mean we should the studios throw a bunch of money.
Although both of those movies were commercial successes and critical successes.
That's true.
So there's that. But Seven particularly was much bigger than anybody anticipated. But still with this subject matter, that's basically kind of, you know, going, this movie's produced by Fox, going against Fox, you know, like it's crazy. I can't believe there wasn't more interference or that so little of the book has changed, even though it's this very sort of, I don't know, those
subversive.
It's a very polemic voice. Polemic. Yeah. It's this very polemic voice. And like it barely changes, if at all.
Do you mean just how anti-corporate it is?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely anti-corporate. Do you see a lot of kind of political and social stuff, or do you think it's mostly focused on kind of, you know, financial capital?
I think it's
businessy kind of stuff.
It's very much, I think it's a very personal movie type of thing. Like it really focuses on these things, the way people react to these things. It's more that. About the personal side of things than the actual corporate side of things. You know what I mean?
Oh, just the way that affects us, much about how that actually functions.
Yeah, when we start the movie, this world is established, and now it's just this world influencing this person.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you like Edward Norton in this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you not?
I'm fine with him. I'm not...
I've never been the biggest Edward Norton fan.
Yeah, and I don't really hate... I hear he's a total dink, but...
Oh, yeah, he's a douche.
That doesn't really matter.
I like him a lot in 25th Hour at parts, but other than that, I've always just enjoyed him. I don't think he's a great actor, but I think he's very good.
American History X?
I don't know, man. Something about that movie doesn't... kind of rubs me the wrong way. I think it's also the basketball scene. I can just never get past that because it's so bad.
Why? The basketball's bad? Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like when somebody's talking about, like, making music references in a movie, it always feels awkward because generally I get it. Like, when Juno's talking about the Melvins, I might not listen to the Melvins, but I know the Melvins are a thing.
Yeah.
If I watch somebody playing basketball that clearly can't play basketball because I've dribbled a basketball in my life, then I notice that and it's like, oh, this is the worst. It's sort of, I assume this is how scientists feel when they watch Michael Bay movies, you know? It's just like, it's just, if it's a world you know... and you see it being done incorrectly or in a way that feels in any way wrong, you're just sort of like, it just takes you out of it.
So you're saying your dunks are better or worse than Edward Norton's dunks?
My dunks are just as unrealistic as Edward Norton's.
I guess they approached Matt Damon to play Edward Norton's character, who I'm going to call Edward because he never has a name, and I usually end up calling characters by their actor's name anyway.
Edward's good.
We'll call him Edward for the time being.
Jack is generally how he's referred to when people are talking about him.
Because Jack's brain part,
I think Matt Damon, he's a little too pretty, I think.
Yeah.
Another point of, like, he can't be close to as pretty as Brad Pitt. In 1999, Matt Damon was a really good-looking guy. Yeah. It was before he sort of turned into, like, this weird cube guy. But... Well, it's weird. Like, the way he's built muscle over the years has been very odd. If you look at Matt Damon now compared to 1999, it's really weird.
I just always baffled by how well you remember and notice people's physical attributes.
Well, I've seen Good Will Hunting, and I've seen The Bourne Ultimatum, so, you know, I could see a difference.
That's fine.
And that's the thing, like, Tyler Durden has to be sort of, like, an ideal vision for a guy. Like, because Brad Pitt looks very, in 1999, looks very much like what... I don't know, the sexiest man in the universe, you know? Like,
yeah.
If you are a figment of your imagination, you're probably going to look like Brad Pitt, you know? But yeah, Jack couldn't be played by somebody that as good or as anywhere near as good looking as Brad Pitt.
You know? Okay. I was going to get to this later, but now it seems like a good time. Mm-hmm. So you're really happy with Brad Pitt as Tyler Durden?
I think this is his best role. This is his best performance by far. It's not, second place isn't even close.
And do you find any... a problem with kind of the things they talk about and then the things that Tyler Durden talks about in being played by Brad Pitt. It just seems like he's so much of the movie he's kind of rallying against popular culture and, you know, image and not necessarily Hollywood, but things, you know, like that. Just very image based, you know, doing things for appearances, just the way things look. Do you think it's weird to have a very good looking, very famous, like A-list celebrity play this character? Do you find that hypocritical at all?
In what way?
It just seems like
Because Brad Pitt's film choices are very interesting. Like, the movies he chooses to appear in are very... He has a really interesting career. Like, the most clearly Hollywood thing that he's chosen to be in that I can think of off the top of my head is Ocean's 11. And even those are kind of interesting movies just because of the totally different style between all three of them. Like, his celebrity is mostly based on the fact... Initially, at least until around 2004, is based on the fact that he's just super crazy hot. And that's why he became a celebrity, and that's why he was sort of like this face of pop culture. But he was always being in interesting movies. Like, I mean, Meet Joe Black apparently sucked, but that was a big budget flop. But, like, he doesn't have a lot of huge box office successes, and even the ones he does appear in are a bit more interesting than, you know.
Yeah.
He's not Channing Tatum, you know, like, just sort of being in Dear John just because it'll make a buck, you know?
And Dear John to the vow. I just mean the scene that really drives us home for me is when Edward and Tyler get on the bus. Mm-hmm. And then there's I think it's an Armani ad or something on the bus.
Yep. Self-improvement is masturbation.
Yeah. And it's a close up of like a guy's abs and underwear.
Yep.
And Edward says, "Hey, is that what a real man looks like?" And then they all joke about it, and he and Tyler laugh about how it's not and how it's silly to look like that. And then you see Brad Pitt with no shirt on and it looks very similar.
Yeah. Well, the, I suppose the thing is that Tyler Durden is a creation of society and or a product of society, and Brad Pitt's fame is kind of a product of society as well. Right. So you could sort of make the argument that Brad Pitt is a product of this society. Yeah. You know? I know that's, it's a reach, but no, I don't have a problem with that. Because he's still a figment of Jack's imagination. So he doesn't have to sell. He's not self-improving. He's just being psychotic and inventing people. And that person just happens to look like that.
Yeah, I just feel like in the movie, he's supposed to be this force that's about, you know, making people, you know, more real and not so worried about image and looking good. And as you said, he's like the hottest thing going.
Mm.
And I don't know. That's just always been one thing for me that I... And I don't know what the solution is. I'm not saying just find the ugliest person and hire them, because I don't think that would make sense or work either. But it just seems like they do so much about how, you know, modern culture is just so empty and vacuous. And you have this guy who is kind of the figurehead of it as that character who's saying all these things.
But
I agree that he does. The Channing Tatum point is a good one. He does things that are a lot more interesting. He could coast and just play a pretty boy for... You know,
that's the thing.
His entire career, if he chose to.
You would be 100% correct if Brad Pitt was empty and vacuous. You know?
Like, yeah.
And that's the thing. He's kind of an interesting person. I think he's not as smart as people give him credit for, but he's not an idiot. And he, like I said, he gives a really, really great performance. If he was bad in this movie, and I really, like, it's one of those roles that I can't picture anybody else doing.
Yeah.
It's just right. Brad Pitt as Tyler Durden is correct. You know, like, I could picture 1,000 different people playing Jack, you know?
Yeah.
Or Marla Singer as well, you know?
Like, but... Janine Garofalo?
Sure. That would be great.
She was approached. Janine. She was approached first, really? And objected to the sexual content.
Oh, yeah, that sounds like a Janine Garofalo.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would be kind of interesting. She would have fit, I think.
Well, no, I don't know. I see what you mean, especially because... He does do interesting things like that. And part of this character is, especially when you find out, you know, the true nature that it's just a figment of Edward Jack's imagination, is it's supposed to be something desirable. Mm-hmm. As you said, like, this is how you would wish, if you could make yourself look like anything, it would be this, right?
Yeah.
So, and I definitely see your point on that one, that it has to be someone who you would really, really want to look like. Or,
yep.
You know, that makes sense to me. So... David Fincher,
yes,
director, said that this is The Graduate for people in their 30s.
Yes, I completely agree.
I had
that in my notes.
You agree that he said that, or that this is The Graduate of for people in their 30s?
I agree with both.
Okay.
I believe both. Yeah.
How so?
Well, the difference, it's sort of like, if he says it's The Graduate for people in their 30s, I get that, but I think it's more of like the anti-graduate, because in The Graduate, Dustin Hoffman's character, Benjamin Braddock, he's trapped by all of these options. He doesn't know what to do, and he's got all these options, whereas, and that's in 1967. Now we go to 1999, where you've got this 30-year-old, and he feels trapped by his lack of options.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like the world has completely changed in those 32 years, and... now it's changed that this is kind of the only way we're allowed to live, or it's the way that we're told is correct way to live. And that's how I think it's sort of like the anti-graduate. It's sort of feeling trapped, not by having so many choices, but by having no choice.
Right. So, and what happens in the meantime that made that change then? Is it an age thing or is it a generation thing?
Now, how do you mean? Like in...
like...
well, okay, let's look at the rise of commercialism, like commercial society generally gets attributed to the 80s. You know, we've got yuppies that sort of see self-improvement as, buying a new couch.
Yeah.
You've got Michael J. Fox's character on Family Ties that was originally supposed to be kind of a villain, being the thing that people like.
Yeah.
Because he's the conservative, money-loving kid.
Greed is good.
Yeah, yeah. Gordon Gekko, the rise of MTV. Yeah, it's just sort of that type of thing over, you know, it started in the 80s and was, you know, very prevalent in the 90s when Polanyi wrote the book. Okay, and then like 1995 or 1996 when the book is published, there's sort of like a reaction to what happened in the 80s that continued on through the 90s, and it's just sort of starting to feel trapped. And then the movie comes out 3 years later, which is, you know, fairly standard length of time that it needs to take place. So, you know, it's just sort of a reaction to the world that was building and really hit a boom in the 80s, and then really got a reaction in 99.
And what about the ending as far as the graduate versus
the ending? The Fight Club ending is interesting because I don't have a take on what it's trying to say at the end. I think the only idea the movie's trying to get across, I don't think the building's blowing up really matters so much as the fact that Tyler Durden was going to blow up buildings. And it's just sort of like, it's just saying that it's the thing I said earlier, that society will create these Tyler Durdens or these people that will listen to Tyler Durden.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and that's sort of it. I love the last scene. I think like the pacing of that scene is just incredible. Last night when I was watching that movie again, I watched that scene like three times.
You
I think
love
it's great.
That ending so
it's
much.
No, I don't love the ending.
You love just that shot of all the buildings falling.
No, and that's the
and
thing.
The pixies coming
even,
in.
Yeah, it's the pacing of that whole scene. Like from once he kills Tyler Durden until the end of the movie, it's just something about that pacing is just perfect.
Okay. Now what about, I mean, the ending as the way that, what's his name in The Graduate? Benjamin
Braddock.
Benjamin Braddock. He makes a choice at the end, and he goes with the younger girl mm-hmm. instead of her mother or neither of them.
Yeah, yeah.
This ending of Fight Club, does he choose, are his options to be, you know, be Tyler or accept Tyler or however you want to phrase that, and Marla, and he chooses Marla? Is it kind of the same thing where it's someone kind of has two choices and they pick sort of the middle ground?
I don't think so. I think it's more of a, because he does try and stop Tyler.
Yeah.
And succeeds to a point. But the point is that Tyler has already done these things that are kind of unstoppable. And it's just sort of like, well, by the time you realize what you're doing is wrong, it's too late. That type of thing.
Okay.
Because he's not really, he tries to save Marla. He tries to get her out. Like, he doesn't want her to be in that last scene, you know?
Yeah.
It's just sort of, well, she's here, we might as well hold hands and watch the world blow up, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think that's a choice at all.
Might as well hold hands, though. That's not necessary.
You're about to watch five buildings. You know, like, you're going to see a pretty giant act of terrorism. It's kind of terrifying, you know? Why not?
Okay, yeah, it's fine. So are we supposed to see, is it kind of a halfway, like, we're glad he's dead, but we're happy the buildings are going down, or we're upset about all that? And how does Jake Edward feel?
I think Edward is ambivalent, and I think myself as a viewer, I'm ambivalent.
Okay.
And I think that kind of proves the point of the movie a little bit.
Yeah, we'll get back to that ambivalence, I feel like. Fincher said Fight Club, the violence in it, because it got some heat over the violence.
Yep.
And
yeah, it's pretty intense.
Yeah, and again, yeah, just the violence altogether, it seems kind of half-assed, as though this is what we really need. Like, this is his solution is to start these fight clubs at first. We know it goes to Project Mayhem and that Tyler probably had something else in mind the whole mm-hmm. time.
No, no, I don't think that's correct.
No?
I think the idea is that they do, they fight as a way, it's sort of like the most basic, you know, it's sort of like hunting, you know, it's like, we're just
just attack, you know, like really basic things. And then that sort of like gets to Project Mayhem. It's like, oh, we like this. Let's go attack other things, you know?
Yeah. And so that. And they seem surprised when Fight Club spring up on their own and how big it got. Like, I don't think they expected it to be this big and use it as a recruiting tool. I still can't get over that part. And I see exactly where you're coming from. And the first time, I mean, when I watched it the first time, it's that makes sense to me too. You know, we live in a time with technology and they say it in the movie, there's nothing left to hunt. Like we, you know, we just acquire things, but there's no kill.
Still the most dangerous game. Man. Zodiac throwing that.
But I just feel like he's concerned about all these problems in the system and what they're going to do. And I just don't feel like violence is the answer.
That's the point. Like what it doesn't say that these decisions that they're making are correct. I think it says the opposite. I think the idea is that they do such extreme things. So you can be like, whoa, this is fucking crazy. This, you shouldn't do any of these things. It's just saying that the movie sort of, you know, this movie's like a science fiction movie, you know, and it kind of is a science fiction movie. And it's just sort of saying that this is a modern society with this fake this is a reflection of modern society, but this character inside it is just sort of showing how all these trapped people might eventually feel, you know, and that's what it's saying. And it's sort of this, you know, let's say Planiac is probably a better example, but Planiac feeling sort of trapped in this world, and Tyler Durden is the character he creates to do these things. So it's that. It's the Tyler Durden is this totally fictional, non-real character, and he's doing all these things that people kind of wish they could do, but know are crazy, and they shouldn't do. And that's why the movie, you know, they do all these crazy things, but they're never doing the right thing.
It's kind of a
caution. And that's why Jack eventually tries to stop it. You know?
And so it's kind of a cautionary tale, like saying this kind of mentality is only going to lead to horrible
Absolutely.
So don't act like Tyler and be happy with Edward's life?
No. It's not saying, it's not giving you a suggestion as to how to act or how to not act.
Well, that's what cautionary tales do, though.
Yeah, I guess. Well, okay. Well, then perhaps it's not a cautionary tale. But it's saying, that this is what the society creates or could create.
Okay. Do you know the website What Would Tyler Durden Do?
I know it exists.
Okay. That's enough.
Okay.
I feel like the reason that website exists and the reason why most people I feel really love this movie and why all these posters get sold is because people want to be Tyler Durden and act like him. And I feel like that's where a lot of the cult following of this movie comes from. And that I don't find that lines up with this opinion that he's horrible and you shouldn't act like him. And this is one of the worst things that can happen.
Yeah. Well, movies get misinterpreted.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I don't know. That's kind of the crux of it for me, I think, is that people who love this movie most of the time love it for that reason. And it seems
they also love it because it's a really entertaining movie.
It's arguable.
Okay. We'll argue this. Your opinion. Ridiculous. Continue.
What's ridiculous?
Okay, well, you just explained in the intro, the reason you don't like it is because you had 12 years of people telling you you would love this movie, telling you things. You knew the ending, which is so key to enjoyment of the movie. So you're judging it with all of these different qualifiers than people that see it in 2000 or 1999.
Yeah.
So you couldn't be surprised by the movie, and the best things in the movie are kind of surprising.
I know, but people rewatch it and aren't surprised by anything. That's why it's a cult.
You still kind of, like, you still have the image of first seeing it, you know?
Yeah.
The Sixth Sense is a worthless movie if you know that Bruce Willis is dead the whole time. There's no point to watching that movie.
I think it's got some cool stuff in it.
Okay. Well, it's a drastically different movie. You know?
Yeah. And no, it's obviously, you're right. It's impossible for me to judge it the way that other people have. I just feel like the message is so unclear and self-contradictory is one reason I really don't like it.
Okay. I do not agree.
The whole twist ending, yeah, of course I knew it, so it's not gonna have the same impact, but it just doesn't make sense.
It's a science fiction movie.
It doesn't make sense internally, though.
How so?
Like, there are scenes where, I know the obvious response to most of the stuff is that he's an unreliable narrator, so we can't believe what he sees or says. That's fine.
Yeah, like, how much of this movie happens even in that world? Like, is it even just happening in his head? Whatever. Because in the end of the book, never mind. Continue.
Okay. Yeah, so it's, I really do enjoy a lot of movies and books and stuff where the narrator is unreliable, and that has a good payoff sometimes. But we see things like security cam footage of Edward being dragged by his hair. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense. When we see things from his view and he sees Tyler, I'm okay with that. But we get these kind of shots that are saying this isn't from his viewpoint and Tyler's not there, but things are acting. I mean, when he beats himself up, he could do that on his own. Mm-hmm. But the physics just don't make sense of him being dragged by someone who doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. There's just too many things.
A lot of the actions in this movie don't make sense. I recognize that, but... You know, a lot of the dream incepting and Inception doesn't make any sense. Doesn't mean I don't like the movie.
What do you mean it doesn't make sense?
Oh, I'm going to plug this thing into my arm and go into your dreams?
Yeah, but no, we're giving that. That's part of that whole thing.
What do you mean?
Is that Inception is possible.
Okay.
So what are you saying about Fight Club? That it's the physics don't make sense in this world?
It doesn't exist in reality.
But I'm saying just internally, this movie doesn't make sense.
Okay, that's fine.
Inception makes sense internally. All those other sci-fi movies, okay, we'll give you this, and things are still internally coherent. Mm-hmm. Whereas I don't think this movie is.
Okay, fine.
And to me, that just sucks a lot of possible enjoyment out of it.
Okay.
Jared Leto sucks horribly, but I know you don't disagree.
He's got such a small part.
I know, but he sucks. I'm just listing things I don't like. Okay. Settle down. What else? I don't know. What do you like about this movie?
Everything I've said already. And I went for a few years where I didn't like this movie, or... kind of thought it was overrated, and then it's just sort of watching it again, I kind of realized it's kind of great. And I really like what it says about society. I think it's interesting. Again, I don't think it has to make perfect sense, because a lot of my favorite movies don't make perfect sense and have things that are ridiculous. And another thing I found kind of interesting is that it's kind of, I think it might be about addiction too, which I enjoy, because, you know, it's sort of he can't, you know, at the beginning of the movie, Jack can't sleep. He tries to get drugs for it. Then the doctor's like, no, you need natural sleep. Go to these groups. That's real pain. And then he gets addicted to, what is this, placebo drug, sort of, you know, it's just these groups. And then this type of addiction leads him down sort of this dark hole. It's sort of like a gateway drug to Fight Club, which is a gateway drug to Project
Terrorism.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, yeah. I think that's kind of interesting. It's sort of like this... this thing about addiction as well, but it's sort of, you know, and then you could say this his addiction to commercialism is part of that as well, which I found interesting watching it again. But I just think it's a great movie. I think it's really entertaining. I think it's really interesting, and more interesting than I thought for a long time. But yeah, I don't need to watch this movie again because I've seen it a lot of times, but I will love to talk about it for a long time to come.
Okay. Oh, the support group stuff at the start, mm-hmm. That part I really like.
Okay.
I like his kind of analysis, like when he looks over his apartment and all the IKEA stuff comes up. I think that's good. And him talking about his, you know, addiction to the IKEA and these handmade things with imperfections in them. So he knows that they're made by the native people of wherever. Yeah. I think that's good. I think probably about halfway through, I just find it goes off the rails and I can no longer enjoy it.
Yeah. Okay.
What?
Nothing. Continue.
You're so upset.
No, we've just had this argument. It's that that's where it stops being a reflection of reality, you know, and sort of becomes a reaction to reality. But continue.
Okay. What genre is this movie? Sci-fi?
Science fiction.
Just because so much of it doesn't actually happen, probably, or because it's so mental? Or...
Well, I mean, who knows how much of this movie happens.
Yeah.
I know exactly how much of it. 0% of this movie happens. But, you know, it's sort of like in this movie's reality, like, yeah, is it in his head or not? I think it's science fiction, and that it's sort of like, it's just an alternate version of the world we are currently living in. Like the thing I said with Inception, it's just sort of, this is a different version of our world where these things happen or can happen and, you know, don't happen in our actual world. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's a bit of a comedy, I guess.
Well, yeah, it's funny, but I mean, it's funny in the way that all of Fincher's movies are funny.
Yes, not the most pleasant. Film noir?
I can see it a little bit, I guess, yeah.
Why?
I don't know, just sort of it feels like a film noir.
Because yeah. I saw Black at one point. Yeah.
But Marla Singer never kills anybody, so maybe it's a little trickier then.
Yeah, she's not a very good femme fatale, is she?
No. She's a good femme, though. She exists as a femme.
Do you like her in this?
I think she's good, yeah.
Yeah. Those two, and they're going back and forth and like the support groups and stuff I like, and when she goes to the laundromat and steals clothes and stuff.
Yeah, so I guess it's a goodbye. Let's not make a big thing about it. Oh, how's this for not making a big thing? She's already walking out when I come back to her. I think that's so funny.
Yeah, no, that's good.
This is one of Fincher's funnier movies, for sure.
You think so?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funnier than Seven. It's funnier than the game. It's funnier
Nothing
than Nothing
is funnier than Seven.
basically everything but Social Network is funnier than.
Okay. Yeah, going back to kind of just the generational stuff. I mean, in between... Well, going back to, say, Graduate in the 60s and this coming out in the 90s, almost millennium stuff. Mm. Is this a movie for us, or is it a movie for people from the 60s?
It's a movie for people that were, like, Edward Norton and Brad Pitt and David Fincher's age around the mid-90s. It's sort of like a Generation X movie. It's Generation X's reaction to the world that they grew up in. Where you're sort of being born in the 70s or early 80s, maybe even the late 60s. Can't remember how old Fincher is, but I feel like late 60s seems about right. And it's sort of you're becoming smart around the time that this world of commercialism really starts. And by becoming smart, I mean, you know, becoming an adult, basically.
Yeah.
Or at least a smart teenager. And you're seeing these things happen, and you can see the arc of society, the way it's moving, and you can see the effect the things that are happening have on society. And this is sort of an opinion that these things are bad, or that they don't like these things, because, you know, Fincher exists in a very commercial world, and we only know of David Fincher because of music videos and commercials, which are two of the more commercial aspects of filmmaking. So yeah, it's sort of that, you know. I see that it's very much a Generation X film, and people our age latched onto it because, one, when this movie came out, we were 13, 14. And it's just sort of one of those movies that when it comes out, if you're in high school, it's a really cool movie. The way it's told is interesting, and it's sort of like, you know, if you saw... It's like when people saw Requiem for a Dream, there's a lot of really interesting stuff in there for a 14-year-old moviegoer who doesn't have a great idea of... or this wide breadth of cinema knowledge. And I think Fight Club is better than Requiem for a Dream by a mile. But it's just sort of, it's got these cool things. Tons of cool things happen, or tons of cool way storytelling, the way the camera operates, and, you know, all these visual things. And then, but the difference between Requiem and Fight Club is that, as you get older and watch it, you realize there's a lot in it. Plus, you know, it's a funny movie, which always helps. It's darkly funny, which teenagers latch on to.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like, fuck you, Dad, I'm watching this movie.
This ain't your daddy's knock-knock joke.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of other movies from around that time. Like Boondock Saints has a lot of that, even though it's a pretty terrible movie.
You don't like Boondock Saints?
It's bad. Have you watched that movie?
Yeah.
You don't like Fight Club and you like the Boondock Saints?
I didn't say I liked it. I just didn't know this is how you felt.
Okay.
I would rather sit through Boondock Saints 4 times than watch Fight Club again.
Oh, God. When was the last time you saw Boondock Saints? Were you 12?
3 years ago, I'm going to say.
Wow. That is ridiculous.
That movie's so silly.
It's so bad.
And the Duke is fucking, what's his name? Bill Connolly. Billy Connolly?
Yeah. But yeah, it's just one of those types of movies. But, you know, the thing is that part of the reason we latched onto it, or, you know, me and my friends, I suppose, latched onto it is...
I would never latch onto this. Yeah. And I know I'm not one of your friends.
Because I know I watched it a ton of times in high school. It was one of those movies like Memento, and that I feel like has had a bigger effect on me as a person than I thought at the time. And I remember saying this on our Fincher podcast, that I feel like the ideology in his movies reflects me more as a person than I ever would have thought.
Okay.
Had, you know, before I started researching it. And obviously, I'm not going to burn down a credit card building or anything like that.
You'll blow it up, but not burn it down.
No, sorry. It will burn. It will burn after I blow it up. But that wasn't my fault. I just blew it up, and then it caught on fire. I don't know. And I think there was still sort of this. For some reason, when we were 14, we liked the idea of, well, I guess, let's say pop music around that time was extremely commercial. So the things that we were bombarded by, that the quote unquote kids that wanted to be cool, weren't allowed to like Britney Spears or something like that. Fight Club is so far away from Britney Spears music, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's just sort of like, we're watching this as a reaction to Britney Spears then, and now that we're 25 or whatever, we can sort of get into a deeper analysis of Fight Club, but you know, it's sort of like, yeah. Anyways, but yeah, this is a movie for Generation X that is good enough, and that we've sort of latched onto it as well. And I think future generations could possibly, you know, I would imagine there's an 18-year-old that's seen Fight Club that really loves it in 2012. You know?
Yeah, no, that wouldn't surprise me at all. And I wonder, I mean, in this one, we see things like the Volkswagen Beetle, mm-hmm. which they talk about as kind of. You know, this was a rebellious symbol in the 60s, and now it's, you know, packaged and sold to baby boomers again and a new generation pretending to be rebellious. Mm-hmm. And then I guess in 30 years or something, someone will make a movie with some of our symbols of rebellion being packaged again, right? Yep.
David Fincher keychains.
I would actually buy one of those.
I want a David Fincher silly band, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I have a silly band. It's somewhere around here. Emma gave it to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's sort of like, and Fight Club is sort of, it's sort of, the, like I said, it's this reaction to this world that these people grew up in. And it's sort of this Generation X movie that is kind of the way, and I mean, this is sort of in the way people our age receive it, or people that, you know, weren't there for it initially receive it, in that, in the same way that Nirvana was sort of Generation X's band, and Nirvana comes off of the, like, you got to remember, you don't like Nirvana. You've been vocal about this in our conversations. I don't like Nirvana.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
You don't like Nirvana, right?
No, not crazy about it.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not either. I always used to wonder, like, what's the deal with Nirvana, but I get it now. And the idea is that sort of Nirvana came at the tail end of the 80s. It came after all this stuff. Nirvana took off right after Milli Vanilli got a Grammy for lip syncing.
Yeah.
And it was sort of a reaction of that. And it's just sort of, it's this stripped down authentic thing, you know, like this is the singer songwriter. And also he has a sense of humor.
We play our instruments and actually sing.
Yeah. Yeah. And, he's sort of, you know, Kurt Cobain specifically was sort of doing all of these things that David Fincher as a rock star would do, you know, like
wear plaid and
yeah, exactly.
Nail Courtney Love. Well, she was considered for Marla.
Really?
Yep.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
Her and Winona Ryder.
Nice. Well, Winona Ryder was in Reality Bites, so that would have been kind of an interesting thing. Because anyways, the Reality Bites characters turned into Fight Club characters, basically. Yeah, and I think I read this really interesting thing about, I think it was on Salon, and it was sort of saying that Adele is the new Kurt Cobain, and because she's sort of a reactionary thing to what was going on in pop music. Like, she's so far away from Lady Gaga in that she's this stripped-down pop star who makes really good pop songs, but they are still pop songs, you know? And Nirvana's songs were still fairly poppy. They were just sort of a different kind of poppy, and I mean, we got all these Nirvana clones. We're going to get tons of Adele clones. And it's sort of, I just find that kind of interesting that Adele is Tyler Durden. You know, that's sort of the jump that I made in my mind. And
never would have guessed it.
Yeah, exactly.
I see where you're coming from.
So I thought that was funny. But yeah, I love this movie. I think it's very good. I went through years of my life where I didn't like this movie. I remember trying to rewatch it once, probably when I was 20 or something, and turning it off less than halfway through just because I was like, I just don't want to watch this again.
I want to know why you didn't like it then.
I thought it was sort of really based around its coolness when I was rewatching it. It was sort of like, well, I guess I just liked this when I was young because, you know, it's a very cool movie.
Yeah.
Like storytelling, visuals. But I sort of felt it was, you know, I had started taking film class. I was like, oh, this film's kind of empty.
So one day I'll be like you and grow up and like it again.
It's possible. Yeah, oh, exactly. Awesome.
So, that's good to know.
Yeah, I'm 25, you're 24, you know. maybe in a year you'll like it.
Yeah. You just said visuals. What else do you like about this movie visually?
It, again, it's a very...
Fincherian.
One of the reasons I feel like this movie, watching it now, is probably totally different is because it's a very sort of... Visually, it's a very 1999 movie. Like, it's doing all these things that were really inventive and creative in 1999 that you'll see in every third film now. But, like, the camera movements going from the top of the building down to the basement, you know, and the camera going the whole way. It's all CGI, that stuff. And when the frame actually shakes and you see the film strip when Tyler Durden's doing that, you're not your fucking khakis bit. Yeah. You know, there was a lot of, they dirtied up the film a lot. It's really like a dark beat up film. They did a little bit of bleach bypass, which, gave Seven its sort of look with a lot of grays and a lot of really deep blacks. The outdoor scenes at night, they did this thing called, flashing, which makes the darks, you know, brings out the darks a lot. And it is a very visually dark movie.
Oh, I know how to flash. Don't you worry about me.
Ziggy Sabatka over here. And the Dust Brothers score, this postmodern storytelling that's going on, the twist ending, which, you know, Sixth Sense came out at the same time, same year, like a couple months before. And twist endings became kind of a thing for a bit. I mean, they're still cool when they work.
Endings.
Yeah, when they work, it's great.
Yeah, not like Fight Club.
You. It doesn't count if
it's not
been
much
12
of a twist
movies.
When I had the map, is it?
No. Anyways, yeah, and it's all these sorts of things. Yeah, and I just think it's like, I don't know, when I look at this movie, it just looks like the peak of 1999 film technology to me.
It is dark. And I was reading about this, and the Wikipedia page has like a complicated breakdown of that start where it's his brain and stuff.
Mm, yeah.
Which is totally a forgettable effect now. Like,
oh yeah, but it's so cool. And that's the beginning of the movie.
And I do think that's done well too. Yeah. I do like that part. But I just feel like that's in a movie now and it's such a throwaway special effect.
And it's such a, like, it's really, I think, I mean, rewatching the movie, obviously some of the things become, you know, like, we have the same briefcase, sort of, like, these hints that Tyler Durden are the same.
Yeah.
Is, you know, a figment of Jack's imagination are more obvious. But I think the thing that's really cool about that that opening sequence is that we're coming out of Jack's brain. Everything is coming out of Jack's brain. And I think that's so cool. And then, like, the first thing he's looking at after we get out of his brain and into this world is Tyler Durden.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's this really cool, really subtle way to set up the twist right off the bat.
Yeah, and it definitely goes in with the unreliable narrative. Like,
yeah, exactly.
This might not make sense now. Like, this is purely subjective. It doesn't have to make sense in reality.
And starting at the end and working back was something that was big around that time, started to become big. Dust Brothers score seems very, I don't know, Dust Brothers score is kind of hectic. I don't know that that's necessarily a 90s thing, but I really like it.
They wanted Radiohead.
Did they really?
Yeah. This would hit a lot of, if they got that, there would be even more check marks of,
I wonder what that would have sounded like.
Yeah.
Because I think the Dust Brothers perfectly suit this movie.
But I feel like this could have been done very well by Radiohead. Not that I don't like the sound and music the way it is, but
I feel like
but it's such a perfect matchup, like, just thematically speaking.
Yeah, oh yeah. I think Radiohead would have done, like, more, I don't know, I'm curious. Because then, would it be sort of the things they put into the music around that time, would it have been like Kid A, or would it have been more OK Computer? Because this is right in between. OK Computer was 98, I think. You know, and then sort of they probably would be dealing with the reception of OK Computer, and it would be more Kid A style.
Yeah.
Right? But, yeah, I can totally see why Radiohead turned it down, but I'm happy. I really love the score. I like the Dust Brothers. They produced three really great albums, so. There's that. And M-bop, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. They produced M-bop. I found that out a couple years ago and was just blown away. I couldn't believe it.
The song or the album? Was that an album?
Song.
I don't remember what the album's called.
I don't know.
Helena Bonham Carter looks like a monkey a little bit.
Okay, that's fine. I've always
like an adorable monkey for this, like, most of this movie to me.
The thing I've always enjoyed about Helena Bonham Carter is that her and Tim Burton are hair twins. Like, nobody has hair like Tim Burton except for Helena Bonham Carter, and vice versa. And I think it's really funny that they got married and probably style their hair together every morning. I think that's funny.
Have weird-haired babies.
Probably.
Who are weird. Actually, weird, weird-haired babies because
yeah, exactly.
They'd be very messed up children. Yeah. So you feel that the majority of people who enjoy this movie misinterpret it?
Kind of, in a way. I mean, certainly the 13-year-olds that are like, yeah, it's the best, Project Mayhem, bro. yes, I mean, I know people my age did because my gym class had a fight club. we were not warring against capitalism in that fight club. We were putting on boxing gloves and fighting each other in the gym locker room, you know? Mm-hmm. But
I don't... That's it for me, too. I don't feel like these guys are fighting capitalism when they're fighting under
they're
a
not,
bar.
Or, they're not.
But that's what you just said.
No, it's okay.
That's what you just said.
It's what I just said. And when I'm discussing people misinterpreting the movie. That's what I'm saying. This movie is widely misinterpreted in that it's sort of a statement on this is what could happen. It's saying this capitalism breeds Tyler Durden. Tyler Durden breeds Project Mayhem.
But do you think that they do... Do you think they try hard to make it seem like this is a negative outcome and that Tyler Durden's not someone
you
want to be?
No, because if you go too far with that thing, it always feels heavy-handed and makes the movie significantly worse. I'd rather a movie make me figure things out than feed me. You know?
Yeah.
Like I said, I think the movie's significantly better now than it did 5 years ago, and it's because I get it, you know? And I'm so what if it doesn't – If it dumbs down, then it cuts me out and becomes this sort of, like, this movie that's too broad, and you would hate it because it's too broad. You know, like, it's an extremely fine line that you're asking for this movie to hit. And it's, like, what movie hits this line, you know?
Yeah, I don't know.
Exactly. It either has to be so vague that you kind of takes a while for you to figure it out, and then you're like, wow, that was a really cool movie. That was really smart. You know, it goes just even a little bit too far. And then it's sort of because, you know, you tend to nitpick things sometimes. I do, too. And it's just because we are these type of people that we're, you know, it's either a movie for us. That's also cool enough that young kids will like 13-year-olds for different reasons. But yeah, that's fine. If it was too broad, then, you know, you'd hate it still. Doesn't matter. Just accept that you don't like it.
I accepted that a long time ago.
Okay. You mean like 3 months ago when you saw this movie for the first time?
No, when I fake saw it the first time, I said I didn't like it. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like it's just circular logic, but just Tyler is. Would you say a fascist is a fair assessment of him?
Yep.
Okay. I just feel like this movie brings up these problems, which I agree exist. I'm not arguing that capitalism as it's functioning now is perfect. And I just feel like it brings all these things up and pretends to provide a solution.
I don't think it does at all. I don't think it pretends to provide a solution at all. I don't know if this is a quote or something, but good art asks questions. It doesn't answer them, because the best questions are unanswered. You know, like, that's why they're cool and that's why they're interesting. You know, it doesn't, like, what movie gives us an answer that is really great, like a definitive answer?
No, I know. And I was just about to say that I don't think that the ranking of movies should be this one explained this or this one provided solutions to our economic crisis. Like, that's not how I rank movies either. And yeah, maybe.
Are we sure Mission Impossible 4 didn't solve solve terrorism?
The other guys solved the subprime mortgage crisis. That we know for sure.
Thanks, Adam McKay.
Yeah. No, you could be right that I'm just too wrapped up in people's response to this movie, and I can't just watch it for what it is.
You feel trapped by people's response to this movie, and you are Tyler Durdening against it right now. That is what you're doing. You are enacting Project Mayhem.
I just feel like he's a fascist, which is all about, like, let's live this way. This is the solution. But he's so vague and never has anything to say. And I know you're just...
They say he's a figment of the imagination.
I'm aware of that part of the movie.
Okay.
I did see that.
Are you sure?
Yeah, 100%. But just as I was saying before, I feel like it... And I know you're just going to yell and disagree again. But I feel like it dresses up and says it has a lot more to say about the subject than it actually does.
Again, I disagree, but continue.
No, that's it. That's all I've got.
Good talk.
I'm done.
All right. Thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to send us an email if you want to talk to us. We're decent people. themacguffinmen@gmail.com. Be sure to check back next week for a new episode about something. I don't know what it is, but assuming one of us doesn't kill the other due to Fight Club related arguments, we'll be back. See ya.
Imagine you're a figment of my imagination.
That would be the worst. Why would you pretend to be me? Or invent me? Sorry.
Because it's like Edward and Tyler.
Yeah, but...
You're like this opposite of me.
We're not... How am I an opposite of you?
Because you don't realize how shitty Fight Club is. But I do. And in that way, we are diametrically opposed. Yeah. It always will be.
In that way. In so few other ways.
In that one way, we are entirely opposite people.
Okay. Well, there's a little bonus feature for you in the government listeners. Thanks for listening.
Fight Club loves.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, or follow us on Twitter @themacguffinmen.